On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we review the March 2019 MedPAC report, provide clarification on some pharmacy issues, discuss ACLS and BLS requirements, remind listeners about upcoming Medicare quality reporting deadlines, discuss ASC startup challenges, review infection preventionist requirements, and do a focus segment on malignant hypothermia.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a biweekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 50 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Sunday, March 31st, 2019, recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS. I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts in all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including The Survey Guide for ASCs and the recently released Finance and Accounting for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics, and he is the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. I don't know if you caught that, episode 50.
I know, episode 50. You know, I always had these great plans for episode, 50 when we were going to go back and do a retrospective, but,
Came quick.
I know, it did. You know, it's been over a year and 3 months, I think, since we've been doing this, and, I almost ran out of breath. Doing the intro because of all the things that we're going to talk about today. And I think that's one of the things that we've run into is that over time we used to do things every week. Mm-hmm. And we didn't always have a lot of topics to discuss. But now when we go every so often, we're at twice a month now. Mm-hmm. These episodes are getting longer. And I'm kind of thinking that today's will probably be over an hour. So be prepared, audience.
Mm-hmm. Yep, lots to talk about.
I didn't want to give a hats off to our listeners. Judy D'Ambrosio, one of our former hosts of the show and the Director of Educational Services for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, she was telling me the story that she took one of our clients out to lunch. And when she was in the car, the ASC Podcast with John Gailey came on right away. And I guess she listens to the podcast on her way in. And then she keeps a notepad next to her in the car and writes notes about things. Yeah, I know. I'm a little bit.
As you're saying that, I'm kind of going, we don't recommend that.
No, that's not definitely not recommended.
Or to work and then take notes.
But, she said that this notebook is like full of all these notes. So I felt pretty good that we were, we apparently give her a lot of information that she feels necessary to risk, problems driving by writing it all down.
I'm sure she does it at red lights.
She probably pulls off. And actually, knowing her, I think she probably does.
And we've got our numbers are looking good.
Yes, actually, we're over 300 downloads for the last episode, which is surprising to me. We've actually doubled our listenership in the last month, so I'm not sure what's happening. We must be doing the right thing, but as I was saying to you before we started, it puts a lot more pressure on us. Now we really have to do this. It's not something we do just because we have nothing better to do on Saturdays and Sundays. So it's been a busy couple weeks. So you and I were on the road together a couple weeks ago and spent an entire week in New York City doing things. And last week was our home week, which means that we don't travel more than 60 miles. And it was a fun week to kind of get caught up on things. But it's been very busy lately. And we're going to talk about this in a few minutes about the MedPAC, but there's a lot of action going on right now with startups. And Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies isn't really a company that works with startups, and yet we have four startup projects
going
on.
Didn't used to, but yeah.
So we'll find out in a few minutes why that happened. So let's start, Sue. We had some clarification from a friend of ours, Gregory Tertes from, he's a pharmacy consultant from California. He was listening to a prior podcast of ours, and he just suggested some clarifications to some discussions we had there. So
we heard from Gregory that he had been listening to our podcasts, and he just had a few things he wanted to point out, and so we thought we'd make those corrections. We had been discussing marijuana, and I think we had used the word prescribed. He wanted to point out the differences between order, prescription, and recommendation. So an order, of course, is in a medical record. It's an authorization to provide a certain type of care to a patient. Prescription is actually an order from a prescriber to authorize a pharmacy to dispense a drug or a device to a patient. And a recommendation would be how a prescriber can indicate that a patient will benefit from something like medical marijuana. Since marijuana is still federally listed as a Schedule I medication, doctors can't write prescriptions for it.
And then he suggested there's a website called www.marijuanadoctors.com that has a lot more information about marijuana prescriptions and how that's handled, given the confusing status of state and federal regulations in this area.
Yeah, it's kind of its own category. And we had been talking about the one-hour rule regarding drawing up medications.
Right, just to remind our listeners. So we know that if you draw up medication into a syringe, it is best to use it within 1 hour after it's drawn up. And I believe that we stated, unless there is some additional guidance by the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Yep. You wanted to clarify that. Go ahead.
Yeah, he was just pointing out that the manufacturers, and even information that they are giving, has to do with the stability of the product. So it has nothing to do with the sterility after you pull it up. So, you know, he said this is actually something he gets a lot of pushback on. So really wanted us to clarify that. The 1 hour rule is from USP Chapter 797 that regards the sterility or the infection control.
So in other words, even if the manufacturer says it can be more than 1 hour, from a sterile standpoint, within an hour, or you don't want to keep that the drug in a syringe more than an hour.
Really keeping in mind that stability versus sterility. And so it does have to be used within that 1 hour when you draw it up. And then was it in our last episode or the one before, we had talked about USP Chapter 800, which is about all hazardous drugs.
Which is coming up in November. That comes into effect in November of this year. It's not in effect yet.
Mm-hmm. Mostly surrounding chemotherapy drugs. There are three guidelines in this that he was concerned about with ASCs, and still actually waiting for additional guidance on how everybody should address this. And I know the pharmacy consultant that we work with a lot, George Scores, had some information that he'd been sending out about this.
Right.
So receiving and storage is expected to be in a negative pressure room with these types of medications. Receiving and storage is expected to be separate from other medications and the required use of CSTD, a closed system transfer device. And Midasol is the medication that we're most concerned about.
Because that's the one that's used in eye cases here and most of our ambulatory surgery centers. Really the only hazardous drug most of us will encounter is probably Midasol.
And the manufactured product that is for eyes meets that requirement. The compounded products do not.
Correct.
Those were his concerns, and we just did want to clear that up. And we really appreciate any kind of feedback when we get from people.
So in March, the 2019 MedPAC report, the spring report came out. So first of all, what is MedPAC? MedPAC stands for the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. It's an independent U.S. federal body headquartered in Washington, D.C., and MedPAC was established by the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. The commissioner's 17 members bring a diverse expertise about the financing delivery of healthcare services. And they issue two reports a year about the Medicare payment policy for various types of Medicare providers in the United States, including ambulatory surgery centers. So their March 2019 report was issued, and it's available online. And there's a whole bunch of interesting information here about the industry and about their recommendations that I just wanted to run through at least a few of them. It was like about 14 items, I guess. In 2017, 3.4 million Medicare beneficiaries were treated in 5,603 ASCs certified to provide services to Medicare beneficiaries. So that's 3.4 million patients were treated in ambulatory surgery centers in the country. Mm. And just to remind people, you know, our industry, I guess 5,600 does sound like a lot, but in the scheme of things compared to hospitals and other organizations, it really is a drop in the bucket. And then the next statistic helps show that the Medicare program and beneficiary spending on ASC services was about $4.6 billion, which compared to the trillions that are spent on the program, of course, is, again, a very small amount. MedPAC concluded that beneficiaries' access to ASC services is adequate. Most of the available indicators of payment adequacy for ASC services are positive. In other words, what they're basically saying is that MedPAC has concluded that ambulatory surgery centers get reimbursed appropriately for the services that they're providing, which I think many of us providers would probably argue differently. But based upon their analysis, they believe that looking at all the information they have available to them, that the current reimbursement rates are appropriate. They also concluded that beneficiaries' access to care is appropriate, that Medicare patients are able to access ASC services with little trouble. And these were interesting statistics, especially given what we've been experiencing in the industry recently, is that from 2012 to 2016, the number of ASCs increased by an average annual rate of 1%, which was explains kind of the drought we had for quite a number of years in the growth of ambulatory surgery centers. But in 2017, the number of ASCs increased by 2.4%. And I would venture to say when the statistics come out for 2018 and 19, we'll probably see an even higher rate. Or at least the same rate.
Do you think that was due to the loosening up of the CON standards?
Or? I think that that has an impact on many of the states, yes. But I think also, you know, there probably is some built up demand out there that, that occurs periodically. And of course, as, you know, the changes in the reimbursement mechanisms settle in, you know, a lot of changes have been made. You know, people feel that it's less risky to get involved, you know, once the reimbursement
and settles. The patients, I guess, as word of mouth gets around that people have good experiences,
absolutely.
I suppose it's just going to grow.
Almost all new ASCs in 2017, 94% of them were for-profit facilities as compared to nonprofits that usually are associated with hospitals. From 2012 to 2016, the volume of services per beneficiary increased by an average annual rate of 1.2%. But in 2017, that volume increased by 1.7%. So again, an indication that we're providing more and more services to the industry and that rate might be starting to increase again. Quality of care. They did opine on quality of care. In the first 4 years of ASC reported quality data show improvement in performance, but the measures used within the ASC quality reporting program are changing substantially in the next few years. Among the 11 quality measures for which data were available through 2016, performance among ASCs that reported data improved for most measures. So, and again, that's something we've kind of known. That's one of the reasons that they have been changing the Medicare quality reporting requirements and eliminating quite a number of them is that that performance continues to show improvement. And I guess when you're doing that type of data, you want to find statistics, or I think the government wants us to find statistics that there can be an improvement going on. But here, what they're showing is really all good
data. If it's already good,
Providers' access to capital. So these are for new centers that are starting up. Because the number of ASCs has continued to increase and hospital systems and others have significantly incorporated ASCs into their business strategies, access to capital appears to be adequate. And that, just my experience in working with startups right now has kind of shown that indeed it's not very difficult to get financing right now for projects. We've successfully financed two projects within the last 3 months here with really no major issues and at very favorable rates. Medicare payments and provider costs from 2012 to 2016, Medicare payments for ASC services per fee-for-service beneficiary increased by an average annual rate of 3.5%. So that's the dollar amounts that are going to ASC services. By contrast, in 2017, payments for ASC services increased by 7.7%. ASCs do not submit data on the cost of services they provide to Medicare beneficiaries. Therefore, the commission could not calculate a Medicare margin as they don't have access to cost information in order to be able to do that. So on the basis of all of the previous items that we've discussed, the commission concluded that ASCs can continue to provide Medicare beneficiaries with access to ASC services with no update to the payment rates for 2020. So unfortunately, their recommendation is that no payment increase should be made for 2020. Now, they basically do this every year. They basically continue to say that ambulatory surgery centers make plenty of money and therefore No increases necessary. And the commission has also been recommending for many years that ambulatory surgery centers complete cost reports. Now, most other providers in the United States, including hospitals and nursing homes and home health agencies, have to prepare an annual cost report that's filed with the federal government. And MedPAC continues to recommend that they do the same thing in the ambulatory surgery industry. Now, you know, one state in the United States, that's New York, where we live, does require cost reports be prepared for ambulatory surgery centers. But to my knowledge, that's the only state that requires it. This would be a considerable burden to ambulatory surgery centers. For example, as anybody in New York will tell you, you have to have your financial statements audited, which almost no surgery centers do unless they're forced to, as well as the cost of preparing this cost report and the all of the stuff that comes with it, including just a, you know, much more complex accounting system to be able to prepare the data necessary for a cost report. So unfortunately, the commission really doesn't understand the impact that this would have on the industry and how much of a burden it would have to those organizations. And speaking of somebody that prepares cost reports and has worked with cost reports over, you know, the 30, 40 years I've been in the industry, these cost reports have very limited usefulness because of the complexities in trying to put cost information onto a form. And a lot of, by the way, the forms are actually dated themselves, and a lot of them were prepared in the 70s, and really very minor changes have been made to them over the years. So I find that they have very limited utility. So I think that's an unreasonable request. Unfortunately, CMS has not taken any steps to implement that over the years, and hopefully they will not this year too. But for our listeners, please understand that this is a recommendation of MedPAC. For the most part, CMS has ignored these recommendations when it comes to cost reporting as well as the fee increase. So fortunately, even though our fee increases haven't been large, CMS has allowed them to occur. So let's talk about Medicare quality reporting since the deadlines are fast approaching. We have to remind our listeners that significant changes in Medicare quality reporting requirements have occurred in 2019, and this has led to a lot of confusion in many of the centers. So, Sue, do you want to clarify the 2019 requirements?
Sure. To comply with ASCQR requirements and avoid payment reductions in your 2020 Medicare payment rates, ASCs must submit the following data. ASC9, endoscopy polyp surveillance, appropriate follow-up interval for normal colonoscopy in average-risk patients. ASC10, endoscopy polyp surveillance, colonoscopy interval for patients with a history of polyps, avoidance of inappropriate use.
We should point out for 9 and 10, even if you're not an endoscopy center, you still have to report no numbers here, right? Well, you have to put zero for the denominator and the numerator here.
ASC 13 is for normal thermia. ASC 14, unplanned anterior vitrectomy.
So hopefully all of our listeners have been gathering this data, and certainly they've been given a lot of information over the years about doing this. For the 2020 Medicare payment rates, which we're gathering data for effective May 15th, in other words, they have to be filed by May 15th, you need to report these four categories of information in order to not have a payment reduction in your 2020 rates. So data has to be submitted through the qualitynet.org website by the deadline of May 15th, 2019. And really, Sue, you and I both know this. Please don't delay, because while the reporting is very fast, I think they can actually do the reporting in less than probably 10 minutes, if that. Signing up for the QualityNet is very time consuming, and doesn't just take minutes, it takes days, you know, because you have to apply for it, and you have to send a lot of information. So remember that for the quality net reporting due May 15, 2019, you are reporting on data that was collected from January 1st to December 31st, 2018. So again, I hope everybody has been gathering that information. We certainly talked about it during 2018 as the year is going on, about, you know, making sure that we had normothermia information and vitrectomy, which are the two new ones. And of course, most of the centers have been doing the 9 and 10 for quite a while if they were involved in GI.
And as you mentioned, if you have no cases of these, you have to put zeros in the report.
Right.
And for more information, you can visit the qualitynet.org website.
And that is where both where you report, and there's a lot of information about how to report, as well as information about the about how you actually do the calculations, et cetera.
And something in an area where there has been a lot of confusion is ASC8, the influenza vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel. The requirement to report this measure was eliminated for 2019. from the Medicare quality reporting requirements. Therefore, you do not need to report this information to the NHSN website.
However, in some states, you are required to report this information of influenza through your state through your state. So if you do have the requirement, make sure you continue to do that. So let's talk about some things that have been going on for the past couple weeks, just experiences that we've had within the company. And Sue, infection preventionist. I know that we've been working with a lot of our infection preventionists. And as we've been taking on new centers and as we've been starting up centers, inevitably there's this discussion of infection preventionists.
Yep.
So do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Sure. At this time, there's no federal requirement that you have a certified preventionist. Some states have regulations that put some restrictions, like New Jersey requires you to have an infection control consultant, a CIC, as well as an in-house infection preventionist with training. Some states, such as New York, are considering acquiring a certified professional.
Right. And on behalf of the CAPE credential, the CAIP credential, which is a product of the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification, which I'm a member of, we have been working to try to make sure that the states that are considering requiring certified professionals understand that the CAPE credential is the best credential, and that's specific to the ASC industry. So, so the issue continues to be that until the CAIP credential came out, there was no certification that was specific to the ambulatory surgery center industry, and the CIC credential, which is from APIC, is largely geared toward hospitals, and it's an excellent credential, but the individuals that have the CIC often, by the way, wouldn't even meet the requirements to be a professional in the ASC industry because, for example, you have microbiologists that have the CIC credential, but a microbiologist cannot be an infection preventionist in an ambulatory surgery center.
Okay, so the training issues are really a problem. So ARN has a course for training ASC infection preventionists, but it's only 6 CEUs, and it's really just more of an introduction at this point.
Right. And this is for most of our clients that have a brand new infection preventionist. This is the course we usually recommend for those individuals. It's very quick, gives you a good background in ASC infection prevention and what the role is of the preventionist in setting up a program. But it really is only an introduction. So while it will meet the requirements for CMS and accreditation for demonstrating that the preventionist has training in itself, you know, if that's the only thing you have, it doesn't really demonstrate that they have ongoing training. So the ASC Association, which I do quite a bit of work with, has been developing some much more advanced training in infection prevention and infection preventionist roles and responsibilities. And this can constitute training for CMS and accreditation purposes, but we need to make sure, you need to make sure that you're diligent in providing the proof of the training and what you were trained on. So the best thing to do there is when you attend conferences such as your state association or the ASC association, either the like the upcoming 2019 conference, ASCA 2019 conference, or the ASCA 2019 winter seminar, where there's quite a bit of information, print out the certificate you get after you've attended the conference, as well as the list of the courses that you took or the sessions that you took, and an agenda for those sessions, or at least a printout that shows what was trained in it. And that will help demonstrate to surveyors that you're keeping up on what's going on in this. And just an FYI, we are going to be working on our podcast with trying to provide additional training in this area, and we're going to be working with our infection preventionist, our CAIP certified preventionist, who's Lori Rodericks, who has agreed to do a couple sessions on this. So look forward to working with her shortly. And I just want to warn you to be very wary of organizations that are touting training for preparing for the CAPE exam, the CAIP exam, especially if they don't have individuals that are CAIP certified themselves. So we just noticed that a number of organizations have been putting out advertising about this, and we are, you know, just concerned that you're not going to get the right training or that you're not going to be really prepared for the CAIP exam. So really, you know, following the ASC Association training programs is probably your best preparation for that. Next, as we've been talking about, a lot of new surgery centers are popping up. And our, you know, the funny thing about our company is that we never really were involved in startups. And yet, as we talked about before, we have 4 of them going on right now. So a lot of it is just because, you know, friends of People that are clients right now have been starting up centers, and they ask mm-hmm. us to help out. And before you know it, we're full fledged
becoming experts.
we're full fledged experts in it. And Jen Alvarez, who is our senior nurse consultant in charge of all of our startups right now, mm-hmm. Has no time to sleep, I believe, right now because of all the things that are going on. So she's been very, very busy with that. So there are a lot of new centers starting up. The hardest thing for owners to understand, new owners of ambulatory surgery centers, is that running an ambulatory surgery center and running a physician's practice are about as different as major league football teams compared to Pop Warner teams. So,
and an important part of that is hiring a competent administrator and nurse manager. That's just critical to this. Nurses that spend their career working in a hospital environment often find it's a really difficult transition because it's such a different environment.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of experience with this. Not to say that it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. but really it takes a special nurse who is willing to, is understanding that you're in a completely different environment. You don't have all those support services back there to help you, and that, really speed of turnover, mm-hmm. Catering to the needs of the doctor are extremely important in an ASC environment, where in a hospital you've got other factors that are going on, including emergency procedures that have to be done. So it's important that these nurses understand that it's going to be a different environment.
Yeah, it can be very difficult to adapt to that. And if you can't find someone who has experience and that has done that before, you may need to hire professionals like us, for instance.
That's exactly. Sounds like a blatant sales pitch there. But I guess our point is
important to have somebody that knows what they're doing, somebody that's done it before, even if it just is based around the training.
Right. And we know it's very difficult to find, good ambulatory surgery center administrators and nurse managers, simply because they're good, mm-hmm. they're already working in a stable environment right now and are very busy and very happy with what they're doing. That's why you also have to be very careful looking at resumes, for example. Mm-hmm. You and I have run into situations where, our favorite term is that one of our clients called us up and said, I have a real rock star, mm-hmm. For the nurse manager position. Yeah. And you and I both said the same thing. I hope he doesn't mean like really a rock star.
and sometimes they are in the setting that they're in. They could be a great nurse. They could be a great charge nurse, whatever, but it's, as you said, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, you got to be very, very careful. I mean, one of the things that we found over time is that sometimes they say that they have a lot of experience and mm-hmm. accreditation. And then when you actually query them a little bit more, mm-hmm. what they meant by that is that a surveyor asking a question once during a survey mm-hmm. rather mm-hmm. than they were actually the point person for an accreditation survey. So, look at those resumes very carefully when you're recruiting somebody for the position, and don't hesitate to hire people that have been through it before if you need help. It's you don't have to go it on your own, and it's dangerous to go it on your own. So it might sound like a pitch here, but really, I'd much rather say this now than mm-hmm. have to walk into a place that has kind of made some major missteps or spent a lot of money and had problems starting things up.
Mm-hmm. And also, just taking advantage of all of the conferences that are out there, making sure if you do hire somebody and they need a little bit of strengthening, getting them involved, getting mentors involved with them. There's a lot of information out there to make sure that you're not missing critical aspects of it.
Right. We're coming up on my 30th consecutive Ambulatory Surgery Association meeting. And now, of course, the organization has changed names over time, but, I've been to every single conference since 1990. Mm-hmm. And in 1990, when I started our first surgery center in Rochester here, I didn't know what I was doing. Some people say I still don't know what I'm doing, but in 1990, I truly had no experience at all. Mm-hmm. And I attended my first conference, met a whole bunch of people that really got me kickstarted into this career. And I learned a lot and was able to take that back immediately and use it, in preparing for all the challenges that we would have in starting up surgery centers. So please, we're going to talk about ASCA 2019 at the end of the podcast. But if you are starting a new surgery center, if you're a doctor or a nurse involved in it, anybody that has any involvement, do consider going out there because you'll learn an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And we also need to make sure when preparing, new centers, when they're preparing to start operations, make sure you know the state licensure laws, which is kind of obvious. Know the federal certification laws, know the applicable accreditation standards, and recognize that not everything is going to be ASC-specific standards. For example, you still have to follow the OSHA regulations, the HIPAA regulations, fraud and abuse, labor laws, etc. And also check your state reporting requirements. For example, those that are starting up centers in New York and Pennsylvania, another state that we do a lot of work, are often surprised at how much ongoing reporting is required there. So make sure you know that very well. And if you have any questions, you know, contact the state associations to assist you on that. And lastly, I just want to mention that software is always a big issue when you're starting up a surgery center. You really should not be using software that you use for your office, especially the electronic medical records. So consider that you're going to have to spend some money on developing or purchasing a new software system that is really specific to the ambulatory surgery industry.
And lately, we've been dealing with some questions about the requirements for staff to have BLS and ACLS.
So let's start with the regulations here. So section 416.44D is the emergency personnel standard. And it states that personnel trained in the use of emergency equipment and in cardiopulmonary resuscitation must be available whenever there is a patient in the ASC. There must also be staff present in the ASC who are trained in CPR techniques. And although the regulation does not require that staff be trained in ACLS techniques, an ASC would be well advised to consider having staff trained in ACLS, depending on the types of surgery performed and the characteristics of the ASC patient population. And then the interpretive guidelines go on to state that for ASCs that perform multiple procedures simultaneously or have multiple persons in the recovery room simultaneously, there must be sufficient trained personnel to deal with multiple simultaneous emergencies. So the CMS standards don't sound terribly strict here, in at least mentioning the number of people that you need to have in it. But often your accreditation standards will be stricter. For example, 888C does state that personnel trained in BLS and the use of cardiac and other emergency equipment and supplies are present in the facility whenever patients are present. And as demonstrated by documentation and training or personnel records, all clinical support personnel with direct patient contact maintain at a minimum skills in BLS. Note that it does not require physicians to have BLS, which is something we had to clarify this week with some clients.
And healthcare professionals with current training in advanced cardiac life support or ACLS are present to provide advanced resuscitative techniques until all patients operated on that day have been physically discharged. It doesn't specify how many, but most organizations will set a high standard. It doesn't say the doctors need it. As we said, again, most organizations may ask for that. State regulations may be higher, so make sure to check with those. And it's hard not to require a doctor to have it since they'll be running the drill. So I know we were kind of surprised when we clarified that.
This is one of my, and again, we're talking about the 888C standards here for an example. But, you know, one of the issues that I've had is kind of one of my, I guess you call it a pet peeve, is that, you know, how can you demand that the nurses have ACLS and assist in running the code if you don't have evidence that the doctor who is actually running the code knows the ACLS protocols. So that's why I think most organizations do set a higher standard and require the doctor or the anesthesiologist, for example, and usually the anesthesiologist or the CRNAs to have that ACLS. But I just wanted to clarify those factors because I know there's been a lot of questions about that recently, especially among our own clients. So that's it for this segment. Let's take a short break and we'll come back and we'll talk about malignant hypothermia.
While malignant hypothermia is exceedingly rare, it's a really serious issue. So we thought we would talk about it in depth right now because we haven't really...
Yeah, in any level of detail. We probably should point out that a lot of our information comes from the MHouse website. MHouse is spelled MHAUS.org. An incredible website, definitely something that everyone should visit if they have to deal with malignant hypothermia. And sign up, become a member. It's only $50 for annual membership there. We'll talk about more at the end.
But yeah, some of the benefits.
Yeah. So Sue, why don't you tell us what MH is?
So a malignant hypothermia crisis is a biochemical chain reaction response. It's triggered by commonly used general anesthetics and the paralyzing agent succinylcholine, which is a neuromuscular blocker. It happens within the skeletal muscles of susceptible individuals. The general signs of the MH crisis include increased heart rate, greatly increased body metabolism, muscle rigidity, and a fever that may exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit, along with muscle breakdown, derangements of body chemicals, and increased acid content in the blood. Severe complications include cardiac arrest, brain damage, internal bleeding, or failure of other body systems. Thus, death primarily due to secondary cardiovascular collapse can result. And also just a lot of damage to these systems, even if they survive it.
Right. And the survival rate is not good, right? Even if you handle it as through the protocols that we know have been established.
No, I mean, if people have the dantrolene that we're going to talk a little bit more about, then actually the survival rate is pretty good. But without that, it's a 70 to 80% mortality rate if it's not addressed. Also, if it's not picked up very quickly, people that are just transferred to the hospital have a very bad outcome because right. you really need to address it very quickly.
Which is why we need to be prepared for it. Now, I should point out that it is extremely uncommon.
Yes.
In my 30 years in the industry, knock on wood here, we don't have much wood here, but knock on wood, I've never experienced it in any of my centers over the years. Mm-hmm. I have known of a center that had an experience with it, and it wasn't good. So this is one of those things that we do because, you know, the consequences of an MH crisis is so catastrophic that we have to be prepared for it, but recognize that it is not something that is likely or hopefully is not likely to happen in the life of an ambulatory surgery center.
Yeah, it's very uncommon, but you can't tell ahead of time who it might affect. So, it is more common in males.
Right.
More in children and younger people. I think the median age is like 22-year-old male.
Okay.
Would be a more typical.
And a family history of it is one of the primary indicators. So like if somebody presents and says that they have a family member who has had MH in the past, that would be certainly an indicator. That would be an indicator we probably not a good candidate for surgery in the surgery center with any of these activating agents.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it can be done. You want to use a different type of an agent.
Right, right. So let's talk about what does trigger malignant hypothermia.
The things that trigger it, and so if you have these at your center that you have to be prepared, are inhaled general anesthetics, desflurane, enflurane, ether, halothane, isoflurane, mesothiflurane, sevoflurane, and succinylcholine.
Yeah, succinylcholine is probably the most common trigger right now that we find in many of our centers. Not a lot of our centers, you know, don't do general anesthesia on a regular basis or tend to use propofol. Mm-hmm. So succinylcholine tends to be the triggering agent of many of our centers. And what I've found is that anesthesiologists often just, you know, they really like to have succinylcholine around because it really helps, you know, make them feel better about, you know, being able to handle any type of a crisis. Mm-hmm. And just a single bottle of succinylcholine in the center is enough to require you to have malignant hypothermia protocols in place as well as the dantrolene. And I've found that sometimes, you know, anesthesiologists, especially if they work in multiple places, they come in with succinylcholine hidden in their jacket. And that is such a dangerous thing. Now, I don't think that's common. Certainly, it's one of those things that I tend to catch on a survey. But, you know, we make sure our centers, of course, are well prepared for this type of a situation. We have long conversations about whether succinylcholine is necessary and the ramifications of carrying it. And we probably should point out here, too, we've talked about succinylcholine a couple times recently there, but succinylcholine is something that should be refrigerated. The minute it is taken out of the refrigerator, it starts deteriorating, and you have to label it, basically, and dispose of it after 30 days, no matter whether you keep putting it back into the refrigerator or not. So as soon as it's taken out, it starts the deterioration process. Mm-hmm. So I guess now that leads us to what do we do if we have some type of a triggering agent, such as using inhaled general anesthetics or having succinylcholine on site? What do we have to prepare for, and how do we be prepared for that? So obviously the biggest thing is making sure we have the drug. So dantrolene, of course, is the drug that is used in MH crises. It comes in two formulations that are not available. One is Dantrium or Revanto. Those are the two different brand names. That is an older formulation, and it requires you to have 36 vials available of these, and expires, I believe, it's about a 2-year expiration on them. So every 2 years, you have to buy another 36 vials, and hopefully during that time, use the 36 vials that have expired in order to do a MH drill.
Yeah, because it's quite a process, right?
It is. I actually did this once. During a drill, I decided I had to try it myself. I am totally unable to even really draw up a vial, let alone put fluids in and mix it. But watching that process and watching during the drill, we had as many employees as we could involved in it. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, one of the things that, kind of really frightened me as I was watching it is the number, the needles flying around, you know, the big needles flying around as they were frantically really trying to reconstitute it. But it is very difficult to reconstitute it.
You have to be diluted with 60 ml
of sterile water. Right.
Each
and then
vial
shake it and make sure that it's completely
dissolved.
And that is no easy task. So
So you want to have 36 vials of that
of available
if that's what you're using.
Right.
And then there's a Ryanodex, which you just need the three vials to be available in each institution where this could occur.
So this is another formulation of dantrolene, if I understand it correct, which is dantrolene sodium. And it is the same price, so you don't save any money, but it is three vials as opposed to 36.
Yeah.
And it is easier to dilute, as I understand.
Yeah, 5 ml of sterile water as opposed to the other. So.
Right.
And I know in a couple of the articles I read that they are always working on improving this because they want to make it a lot easier and quicker to treat somebody.
So so this is one of the things that's needed in an MH cart. And, you know, there's different ways you can do this. You can either have a MH cart, which you roll around with all the items that you need, or put it into a box. I've seen a pretty, large box that is immediately available to carry out there.
Which can be a good idea because then you can have it right there with the sterile water and the other things that you could use in such an occurrence.
So what else needs to be on that MH cart?
You want sterile water for the injection, as we talked about. It has to be without a bacteriostatic agent. It is mandatory to get the dantrolene sodium to its effective site. So, you know, you have to have those and just calculate out how much you need for all the vials.
Right.
The sodium bicarb, 8.4%. You need 50 mLs times 5. Dextrose, 50%, 50 ml vials times 2. Calcium chloride, 10%. You need 2 of the 10 ml vials. You want some regular insulin. They recommend 100 units per ml, and you just need one of those. And, of course, it has to be refrigerated.
Usually that's something that you would actually carry in the center anyway, right?
Yep. And lidocaine for injection, the 2%, 100 milligrams per 5 ml or 100 milligrams per 10 ml in preloaded syringes. You should have 3 of those. Amiodarone is also acceptable. ACLS protocols, as prescribed by the HA, would be followed when treating all cardiac derangements caused by MH.
And then one of the very important things is making sure that you have cold saline solution already refrigerated, basically a minimum of 3,000 mLs for IV cooling available. And it's also advisable to have a availability of a lot of ice or disposable cold packs.
Cool the person down.
Yeah. Yep.
And charcoal filters, having 2 pairs of activated charcoal filters that they want to absorb some of the anesthetic gases that may be still present, even if you stop using that.
Right. So as soon as you go into an MH crisis, you stop, providing anesthesia, but you want to get rid of the residual anesthesia gases that are available, and that's what you do with this.
Yep. And they say after an hour, you would want to replace the first filter. So you want to have a couple in hand. You need the syringes, 60 ml times 5 to dilute the dantrium Rabanto, and 5 ml times 3 for the Ryanodex. And the IV catheters, a 16 gauge, 18 gauge, 20 gauge, 2 inch, 22 gauge, 1 inch, 24 gauge, 3/4 inch, 4 of those for IV access and arterial line. You want a pressure bag to get it in there quickly and disposable cold packs times 4 or lots of ice, as you said.
So how do we prepare for this? Now, the most effective way of doing this is to drill.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we would call one of those internal disaster drills, for example, that you should be doing on at least an annual basis. And if the drill is done and it doesn't go particularly well or people aren't taking it seriously, time to do a second one. We had that happen with one of our centers recently where the staff wasn't particularly in the mood for a drill at that time, I guess. And I won't say we penalized them with that, but we just said, okay, well, we're going to have to do it again. And this time we're going to do it right. So M-House, again, the wonderful website, mhouse.org, has a great drill kit, which has a lot of great information, including some videos. And I believe some of those videos are available on YouTube also. So if you want to jumpstart doing that, you can get that on YouTube.
And you said that they will buy back expired dantrolene, and they also will sell that, so you can
buy
practice using that.
It's really advisable to save your expired dantrolene for a drill. You know, obviously make sure it's pulled out of the stock. But if you
Have any, because I think with such a process like that, it's really important to run through that.
Absolutely. Having seen it myself and seeing how difficult it is. Usually drills, Sue, are run by anesthesia professionals since they're the ones that are most likely to have to, you know, kind of deal with the crisis. So I recently was talking to a CRNA who did one for one of our centers recently. I had a really good conversation with him. He's from Texas, actually. And we ran through what he had done. He did an excellent job. I wasn't there, but he ran through what he had done. I wrote it up for him because, of course, CRNAs and anesthesiologists don't like to write things. They like to make me do it for them. But they did write. We did write up a nice drill for based upon what happened. And you know, he clearly led them through the whole process and what needed to be done. The issue is always, though, so few people have actually experienced an episode, so it is very difficult to make it real. M-House has some videos of how to handle that to try to make it real to you, and I think that's important. The most difficult part about these drills really is the dantrolene reconstitution, if that needs to be done. So you should be doing these drills. Do an SB, you know, your drill should document the process, how you went through it, a timeline of the crisis. And it is also important, as a surveyor, I'll say there's a difference between training on how to handle an MH crisis and drilling on it. So there should be two separate events here. One where you, and it can be on the same day, it can be the same, you know, one can be consecutive, but they need to be documented as two separate events. One is where you go through the training, you describe everything that's involved in an MH crisis and how MH comes to be. And then the second thing is actually doing a real life drill where you act out as much as you can to walk people through that. And a big part of doing a drill is making sure that you have everything you need in order to be able to handle a crisis. And that can be said for any drills that we do, by the way. We found, I remember a couple years ago, one of our clients did a cardiac event or a code blue drill. And the doctors, this at least was one of the first times that the doctors really took it super seriously. And as they were opening up the code cart, they said, you know, this is terribly organized. You know, we just can't find anything. And you know, the result of that drill was that, you know, they all got together, they decided how they wanted to organize the crash cart, and it was a very good outcome. But, you know, until you actually start pulling drugs out of the cabinet and start using the equipment that's in there, you're never sure you're going to really be able to handle a drill. So do take that drill seriously.
And I think anytime you're doing a drill, don't be afraid to get sidetracked. I feel like that's often what we run into is, you know, the one, I think it might have been that same one, they were talking about, well, where do we put somebody to do CPR? And they were arguing, do we put them up on the cot? Do we put them, what if they're heavier? And you know, I can see people getting kind of irritated, like, okay, let's just get on with it. But a lot of good came out of that.
Absolutely.
And you don't want to have that discussion and that argument when it's happening. So, follow through any of those questions and work through it. At least try to, you know, come up to some type of conclusion.
Well said. You know, a drill doesn't have to be perfect. As a matter of fact, we as surveyors don't expect to be perfect. We want you to learn from that event, and whatever you can do to improve the experience for everybody, it's important to do that. I do want to remind everybody again the M-House resources and thank M-House for all the information that we've provided. A lot of this is from the M-House website. Again, M-House is MHAUS.org. And one thing to remember in an MH crisis is call them. They have an emergency number, a 1-800 number. It's available on the website. So the first thing you do when a crisis strikes is go to mhouse.org and click on the various references there and call the 800 number, and they will walk you through the crisis. And by the way, they can actually do that telephone call as part of a drill too. Mm. You know, it costs some money, obviously, to do it, but something to think about. So we use the mock drill kits within our own organizations. I believe they're working on some new videos that will depict various MH crises, basically simulate them and show how to do it. So I'm not sure that video is available yet, at least not according to the website that I just went up to today. But that should not stop you from buying the kit. You know, M-House will send you the new information as soon as it comes. Comes in a nice binder, has laminated task cards so that you can assign personnel for the various duties involved in an MH drill. You'll have a drill report record, instructions on how to do it, case scenarios, and facts, and of course the various videos for this. And as Sue, you mentioned that they have expired dantrolene available to simulate reconstitution. I believe they'll actually buy back dantrolene for you, or at least give you a free membership, I think, if you ship them your expired dantrolene. So M-House is the site to go to if you want more information about it. And again, most important thing here is be prepared for this. Recognize that having something such as succinylcholine in-house without having an MH protocol, MH drills being performed, policies for it, will create a very serious situation for your organization during a survey. So make sure you're always available for that. And before you add succinylcholine to your formulary, recognize that there's a number of things you need to do. So as soon as that succinylcholine comes in, you know, even having it in-house, even if you promise you're not going to use it, you have to have the protocols in place for handling an MH crisis, which include all of these protocols and things that we've talked about here. So that's it for our discussion on MH. Let's take a short break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the upcoming events.
John, ambulatory healthcare strategies is really growing fast. We've been adding employees steadily over the past 12 months. Can you tell the listeners what's been happening?
So clearly, this podcast has been very popular, thanks, of course, to you and me, because of our wonderful work here and our infectious, I don't know if I should be using infectious personalities in a podcast here about infection control and various items, but definitely we're enjoying doing this, and certainly the word is getting out about the great things that we're doing at AHS. So recently, we added infection prevention consulting to our services and mentoring of infection control preventionists in the organizations, and that's being headed up by Lori Rodericks, who is our newly certified CAIP individual. So she has the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist certification now, and she's always been doing infection control for us, but now she's got this new title. So she can do ongoing infection control consulting, particularly if you don't have a qualified IC person on staff. She can help you in following up on infection control issues. She can do mentoring of infection control staff. And she can do infection control and sterile processing competencies. And we've also enhanced our life safety services by adding Jim Masters to our staff. He is a life safety surveyor, and so he joins Alex Borneman, who is our director of operations, to be able to do various life safety surveys and consulting on life safety issues, as well as probably the most important thing is follow up on life safety citations. That's a very difficult area for many organizations to be able to deal with. You know, what happens when you get a life safety citation? How do you deal with that? So we now have that ability. And of course, our unique retainer-based regulatory services, where we help keep you on top of all the ASC regulatory requirements and always make sure that you are survey ready.
So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry. Every episode, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
I should point out, by the way, Sue, that almost nobody ever sends us this information. So we do search the internet for it. Luckily, a lot of this information is available on the ASC Association website, which I scour to make sure I know what's going on. Some of these I know about because we've been asked to speak at them. But we do want to remind our listeners that, first of all, I'm available to speak at your state associations, any other ASC meetings that you might have. I've been doing quite a bit of speaking, actually, at corporate retreats for ambulatory surgery centers. So, and the ASC podcast with John Gailey is available to support your association meeting or a meeting. And you've probably seen special episodes for various state associations, New Jersey, New York, and Ohio, for example, have done that. And we do special episodes for ASCA, well, you know, like the winter seminars. And of course, we'll have a big presence with the ASCA 2019 coming up. So registration is open for ASCA's 2019 National Advocacy Day, September 24th in Washington, D.C. And for information, go to the ASC Association website.
The next ASC Association webinar, CMS Surveys, ASCA's 2019 webinar series, is April 9th, 2019 from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m.
The Florida State ASC Association's Quality and Risk Management Conference is April 11th, 2019 through April 12th at the Renaissance Tampa International Plaza Hotel.
ASCA 2019 will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee. May 15th through the 18th, 2019.
And we're almost a month and a half away from this. Yeah. It's very exciting. I'm involved in the education committee, so I'm very much involved in various aspects of this coming event. It will be fantastic. I'm very excited about all the content that we have. The podcast will have a big presence there. Almost all of our employees are going to be there. I'm afraid Jenna has to stay home.
Hold down the fort.
Yeah, she has to hold down the fort.
And it's a beautiful place, too.
It is. That
I haven't been there, but I've heard you talk about it.
I know. Anyways. Well, as soon as you walk in, you feel like you're outside, but you're inside the whole time. And and then once you get inside the building, you still have to walk like a mile in order to get to the hotel room. So, you're going to look forward to it a lot. See? The New Jersey State Association 9th Annual ASC Conference is May 28th to 29th at the Hilton East Brunswick, 3 Tower Center Boulevard in East Brunswick, New Jersey, and I'll be speaking there on governance.
The Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology Incorporated, or APICS, 46th Annual Conference is June 12th through 14th, 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The Tennessee ASC Association Membership Meeting is June 19th, 2019 at the MSearch headquarters in Nashville, Tennessee.
Gulf States ASC Conference is June 19th through June 21st, 2019 at the Ritz-Carlton, New Orleans.
And the Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Association Annual Conference is June 27th through the 28th, 2019 at the Camelback Inn and Spa in Scottsville, Arizona. In our next episode, we'll go into the second half of the year. I haven't gotten that far yet, but at least this gets us through the next couple months.
Yep.
So that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in a couple weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button. Thank you for joining us.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.